Hey, we're back here on Downtown at 4:32, your Monday afternoon. Time to get on board the telephone line and welcome in Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and Boston.com. Hello there, Chad. Happy Monday to you. Oh, see that? I pushed the wrong button and there's no Chad. That's what happens when Carrie's not here. Hello, Chad.
I'm here now. How are you?
You sound falling apart, obviously.
I guess so, yeah. I always suspected Carrie carried you, but now I'm finding out for sure.
It's no question. For Carrie, it's like having Kyrie Irving as a teammate.
I would never say that about you, Rich. But yeah, that's a real low blow at yourself right there.
I know. So is there sort of a reverse Kyrie curse that when he goes to other teams, it benefits you?
Yeah, I wrote that in 2019, and now fans are finding out. I'm going to dig that column out and put it on Twitter after Celtics theory. I don't ever really blame the Celtics for trading for him when they did. He was a tremendous talent, and it was reasonable. I mean, he did a shot to beat the 72-win Warriors in the finals. I mean, one of the great shots in NBA history. We knew how good he was. It was worth finding out if he could thrive away from LeBron James as the de facto number one guy. A lot of things went wrong with those Celtics teams, but one of the things right at the top of that list is that Kyrie Irving just could not be a leader. He did not put the team before himself. It really started that first year when he didn't show up for the playoff game, game seven against the Cavs when the Celtics made that improbable run. And we found out pretty fast that he's a selfish guy and a guy who's on his own island. And nothing that's happened with the Nets should be a surprise. I know they had the circumstances that they wanted with Durant and Kyrie unified and going there together, but it always goes wrong with Kyrie. Something always goes off the rails, and you know he's completely hypocritical. I mean, talking about the other night with a straight face about how their team really hasn't been together. Well, that's because you couldn't play the games at home for most of the season. He's just such a headache. As incredibly talented as he is, and there's some things he does, I think, as well as anybody who's ever played basketball. I haven't seen a guard his size with a body control around the hoop. His handle is, he's revered by his peers because of the way he handles the basketball. But, he just is somebody who when the going gets tough, he's really not somebody you want in your corner, and we're finding that out again.
Well, and we're seeing, too, yeah, it's great to have a couple of superstars, but if you have so little depth on your bench that means your superstars have to play 45 minutes a game, it's going to catch up with you eventually.
Yes, and you get to the point where you bring a wheezing Blake Griffin on the court to match up. It's really fascinating to watch that happen, actually, just their desperation to get something, because they have some pretty good role players, but they're all really limited in what they can do. And you look at the way the Celtics are constructed, they can switch anybody on defense. There's not a weak link. So kind of when Peyton Pritchard's on the court, but the effort is still there for him. They know that the Nets try to get matchups, favorable matchups with him, but holds his own more often than not. But you watch the Nets, and every guy really has a fundamental flaw beyond Durant and Irving, and the Celtics are exposing those over and over again. And the number one example of that was when they said, let's see if Blake has anything. And, you know, he played well in offense, threw in a couple threes. I think he scored 8 points. But every time down, the Celtics ran pick after pick after pick till they got the favorable matchup that they wanted, which was Jaylen Brown one-on-one against Griffin, to the point where they just had Jaylen bring the ball up and just go right at him. And when you can do that, when you can just sort of pick the battle that you want to win and know that you can win, that's a tremendous advantage, and it's kind of confirmation of how well-rounded this Celtics team is and how many different ways they can beat you, even with Tatum playing at an elite superstar level and Jaylen a notch or two below him right now. It's really impressive to watch. They have so many advantages over the Nets, and they're exposing all of them.
Well, and we saw that in Game 3, that Daniel Tice and others have done so well to make up for the absence of Robert Williams, that having him back even in limited duty last game was a luxury for them.
It was, yeah. Exactly the way they wanted it to go, really, where they could ease him back into a game, shake some of the rust off, as Ime Udoka put it, and still really not have to rely on him to do anything significant during the game. Just go out there, shake the rust off, get an alley-oop, swat a Drummond shot into the stands, do your Rob Williams things, and otherwise just make sure you feel good. And, you know, that was kind of the most important comment out of the press conferences after the game was Rob said he had no pain in his knee. So exhale, he looked great. They've gotten this far without him, and now they got him back, and they should feel really good about that. And seemed like they handled the whole situation really well, too. They were appropriately cautious, but when he was ready to go, they brought him back and put him out there. And it looks like he'll be full throttle here pretty soon.
And shockingly, I'm sure you couldn't believe this when you heard the news either, Ben Simmons will not play in Game 4.
Yeah, Nash said today he didn't expect him to play at all and never really did. And that's how I felt, too. I felt like it was just gamesmanship to kind of counter the fact that the Celtics were going to have Rob Williams coming back at some point. We've got Ben Simmons, all defensive defensive player of the year a couple of years ago and, you know, number one pick in the draft and all those things. But fact is, he hadn't played since last June. Last June, it went disastrously bad for him to the point where you wonder if he's over it. You know, he talked about having mental health issues, and you have to take it on the level and trust that he does. And maybe some of that comes from the fact that he's humiliated the last time he played basketball. He couldn't make a free throw and panicked, didn't want to shoot around the hoop to the point where he was passing a Matisse Thybulle and giving up open layups. And this just never looked to me like a guy who's physically or mentally ready to play. And I was really surprised when people like Woj and Shams Charania were saying, big surprise, he's not playing in Game 4. Big surprise would have been if we saw him out there at all. And we're not, and nobody should be caught off guard by that.
We're talking with Chad Finn here on Downtown. Well, the Red Sox will begin a series with the Blue Jays tonight. Let's see. No offense, no closer. No vaccination status for guys. Oh, and no manager for tonight. Other than that, things are going great.
Yes, this is exactly how you want to start the season, with a partial roster not hitting or pitching that well. I guess pitching's been okay. And, you know, missing your manager because he's vaccinated but has COVID, but a bunch of guys on the team aren't vaccinated. So, yeah, not fun, you know. They'll hit. I tweeted today, and I think it's 586 plate appearances, which is, you know, it's roughly a season for a player. So you can kind of get some context there. As a team, they have 586 plate appearances this year. 11 homers, 58 RBIs, and they're hitting like, the OPS is like 625. I mean, just terrible. It's like the entire team is hitting like a backup catcher.
I was going to say, so basically the team is Steven Drew.
Hey, that's hurtful. I like him.
I know. That's why I brought him up.
I was thinking terrible catcher. I don't know who that would be. Vasquez over the last year, maybe. last year. They're all Christian Vasquez. But they'll come out of it. We know Devers is going to hit. We know Bogarts will. I don't think Martinez is quite the hitter he was a couple of years ago, but he should probably pop 25, 30 home runs. And Hernandez will probably be maybe not as productive as he was last year, but somebody who's a spark plug anyway. They'll be fine there. It feels like they need to snap out of it now before things get a little bit out of hand and the 7-9 record turns into a losing streak while they're shorthanded a little bit here. Although pitching's been okay, it's been fine, but it just stinks watching it the way it is these days. It's no fun to watch a guy throw four shutout innings to get pulled out, have a reliever come in and pitch four innings, and it's overthinking it, and it takes away from some of the reasons you like baseball. The ultimate example was Kershaw getting pulled with his perfect going. I wonder if we're ever going to see anything like that again, at least early or late in a season, where a pitcher's got some either not completely warmed up to the season or has some wear on his arm. And it just it takes away from kind of that conventional way that you've always enjoyed baseball, where, you know, starting pitchers are trying to get 6, 7, 8 innings, and now it just doesn't work that way, and it's not nearly as interesting.
No, we have Jim Cott coming up next hour, who's been pretty outspoken about the modern game. I can't imagine what he's going to say.
Yeah, yeah. I get email from him once in a while, and Jim Palmer, which is really cool. They're both friends of Shaughnessy's, and they subscribe to the Globe, or I know Palmer doesn't. I'm not sure if Cott does, and we hear from them fairly regularly on things, which is, you know, really cool. My younger self wouldn't have believed that I would have heard from these guys just to talk about baseball every once in a while. And he's so sharp for his age. What is he, like 83 or something?
Yeah.
And still right on top of things, still a good broadcaster. So that's a great, great guest. He's one of the best. And now Hall of Famer.
That's right, coming up this summer. Well, you know, despite everything, I enjoy the heck out of that scoreless game the other night. I have been a fan since they started it, of the whole ghost runner thing. I know some people are like, well, there you go. That's what's wrong. Scoreless game, and then you put a guy on second base. I like that. I still like it because I think it adds a level of strategy that's not often there in the first 9 innings.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of it, but I understand it. I don't like how it messes up the symmetry. Like, you got a guy out there who, you know, gets on base, scores a run, but you don't really have a explanation in the box score for how he got on base, other than he was all of a sudden standing at second base. But I do like the fact that it accelerates the ending of games. Nobody really enjoys a 17-inning game, and it can wipe out your team for a week if you get into one of those really long games and have to empty out your bullpen. So, you know, we see, the Red Sox started the year with 15 pitchers. We don't need teams calling up arms just to cover for a really long game. So in that sense, I do like it. I do like it. It accelerates things. But I also have a fundamental distrust of anything Rob Manfred likes. So that's also part of it.
Well, that's not a bad reason right there. You wrote about this. The ceremony honoring Jerry Remy last week was terrific. The notable absence, of course, of Don Orsillo. But it sounds like it wasn't anything intentional. It was just, I guess, some bad communication on both sides.
Yeah, I think they're kind of both to blame. Nobody really misses Don, and fans aren't over him being let go the way that he was in after the 2015 season. And frankly, he's not really over it either. He's got a great spot out in San Diego, but and he's beloved out there. They really love him out there. But he grew up dreaming of being a Red Sox broadcaster, and he thought he was going to be here forever. And it still hurts a little bit. But they did invite him a week before when they were starting to put all the proceedings together, and he told them he couldn't go. And that wasn't clear from the first thing that he tweeted. It's unclear. He didn't really give me a straight answer. I talked to him a few times. I talked to Tom Caron, talked to other people, the Red Sox, Dave O'Brien. I talked a little bit because he wasn't there that night. And it was clear that they invited him to be there and he couldn't make it. And it was unclear whether the Padres said no or Don just decided because he had a game that he didn't want to miss that game. But they offered him a chance to do a video, but didn't make any promises that it was going to air. That when he said he was going to be there. And then the night before the ceremony, he went to send the video, and one of the people in charge of putting the whole thing together for the Red Sox said, "I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to do this." And was really apologetic about it, but they didn't put it in. And I think the Red Sox should have just found a way to run it. They were concerned about runtime with the whole thing. You remember Garrett Cole complaining that on opening day that
right.
The Billy Crystal ran 4 minutes long. Well, the Red Sox got paranoid about that, and one of the people who was speaking there did run long. They thought he might run long, and they were concerned it was going to tick off Nick Pivetta for some reason. So that was another small part of it. But they should have just shown the video. Just put it up there and show it. And Don should have been probably more cautious about not bringing that up on the night that was supposed to be about Randy. And I wrote a story about it, and I ended it by saying whenever something bad would happen with Nesson or stupid would happen with Nesson or the Red Sox, I would almost inevitably get a text from Remy saying, can you believe this bleep? And it reminded me, you know, this reminded me of, you know, kind of how Jerry always viewed these sort of things, just kind of laughing and shrugging them off. And it made me miss him more, which, you know, was kind of the whole point of the night in the first place. We were supposed to be thinking about Jerry and not anything else.
Did you get a chance to see any of Kevin Youkilis over the weekend?
I did, yeah. I did my media column on him a couple of weeks ago, talked to him about what his, you know, what his approach to the job was. And I like him. I think he's good at explaining the why already, the how something happened, which a lot of ex-players that go into the booth struggle with that aspect right away. He's very good at that. I think he's too anecdotal right now. I know he's watched a lot of Remy and Eckersley, and so much of their appeal was the fact that they could banter and they could tell stories, but they told those stories in 11-1 games, not
right
when the game was close. So he goes off the rails a little bit, but I think they'll rein that in. I know O'Brien's aware of it and tries to help him with it. So I think he'll be good. He's serious about it, and he's got a good personality, and he'll probably get better.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. Chad Finn with us on Downtown. Chad, we appreciate it as always. Thank you for carrying me for these last several minutes. You said you wouldn't, but I think you did. And we'll catch you again soon.
Frankly, I do it every 2 weeks. But
that's no question about
today
it.
Today is a little more pressure.
More heavy lifting than usual today. Thanks, Chad.
See you, Rich. Take
care. See you soon. Chad Finn of the Boston Globe with us here on Downtown.